Herbert Ward interview, April 18th, 1980. Interviewer, Greg Perkins.
Could you give me some information on your personal or family background that would pertain to your involvement at Lockheed and with the IAM?
Well, that's, I would think, reasonably easy. First off, my home is Houston, Texas, which is located close to the Gulf, and that is the Gulf of Mexico. And my people are all longshoremen. And I came up in a home that was trade union all the way. It dates back to my grandfather, who certainly was a strict trade unionist. And just before him, of course, before his entry into the labor movement, the Knights of Labor, which was the formation, more or less, of organized labor. And he used to tell me about this. So coming into the movement, it was one of those things you're born into. It wasn't a thing that you somebody had to tell you about and then you moved into it at a later age. I can well remember many times, of course, that we've had to sacrifice tremendously because of some of the encounters between, say, labor and management, and going back during the early years and 30s, strikes were certainly not uncommon on the waterfront. So the kind of sacrifices that were made by my family, and as I said, all of them were longshoremen, with the exception of my father, who was really a little fella, and they felt then too that the family was monopolizing the labor movement, and they were really trying to keep my dad. They did keep him out. That was the only grounds which they could really they keep him out. But other than that, family background was all strict trade unions. Of course, I was not one to really to follow this. They had all had plans for me. And those plans were that I would go to school. What happened, I had an accident when I was 12 years old, compound fracture, and it left me lame. So my pursuit was that you go to school, you get an education, you can't do this kind of work. And for that reason, of course, I did really make efforts to move away from that kind of work. But then I found that things being as restrictive as they were in Texas, the last year of my high school in Houston, I took it on myself with two other fellows to catch freight train and leave, and with the whole intent, of course, of furthering education, because the kind I wanted, I didn't feel I could get it there in school. And what I really wanted to do was to follow pursuits of art and history. At one time, I was pretty good with a pen, I was pretty good with a brush and things like this, and I knew I couldn't get that kind of education there. And I left, coming to California with these two guys, and that in itself is a story. But we got here after 2 months, and I guess that's brief there.
I was wondering, were the longshore locals in Houston Jim Crow locals, or?
Yes, they were. Blacks were restricted to working. They worked the same boats, but you worked at different ends of the ship, okay? And you had your own foreman, you had your own everything. You had your own local, your own union, which is very, very strong. They did sign mutual agreement anytime there was a strike. And that was a thing that brought them very close together. They found a great deal in common, certainly. And, you know, being small, I can well remember times that they would talk about the strike and having to meet at some times with the whites to coordinate a program. And they would handle it very well.
Wasn't unusual for black people of the 30s and the 40s to be involved in the union movement, as far in Los Angeles, let's say, as opposed to the South?
Well, you have to understand Los Angeles. Los Angeles was what was called an open city. The labor movement prior to World War II was primarily restricted to the building trades, I would say. Strong unions within the building trades. You didn't find outside of the railroad, I would say, skilled and craft unions that were really strong. They were small unions. And with the advent, of course, of World War II, then you found the movement spreading, and of course there had to be a number of things done at that time, because just prior to that, you know, the CIO, which certainly was at variance with some of the conditions and policies within the AFL, and there were no restrictions as far as CIO was concerned, and they had brought in everybody representing people industry-wide. And there were unions within the AFL who recognized that unless they did likewise, they served to be defeating the purpose of trade unionism. And it was with that idea, of course, that the machinists, the IFM, become an industrial union where it too would have competed and did compete with the CIO. And I can remember a number of real strong fights between the CIO and the IFM. And so, answer your question is that unions weren't seen here in Los Angeles. There was a comparative difference between, say, San Francisco area and Los Angeles, because it's all unions. There has been for years, and quite a difference.
Right. Okay. You mentioned that the IAM had a different attitude, that they were more going in the direction that the CIO unions were as far as industrial unionism.
Industrial unionism.
And is this why did they make any overtures to blacks directly, or is it more a question of the blacks trying to get in and then they dealt with you once you were there?
Well, within the IFM, there were people who recognized unless they really worked in the area of moving everybody within the organization, that they weren't correcting anything really, even though it was industrial union, unless they accepted everybody. The same basic CIO did. But there were few, and their voices certainly weren't strong within the movement. But the fact that there were some, and they recognized that unless they did this, unless they brought the blacks in, brought minorities in, blacks particularly, because there was nothing against the Mexican Americans and others, just blacks, that they served to defeat their purpose. So blacks recognizing that they weren't going to be accepted on the same basis as whites, some made efforts to get into the union, and certainly including myself. I didn't know that there were restrictive conditions in the union until I got into the union. Well, actually, it happened, I think, by accident, because when I joined, well, when I was employed at Lockheed, I asked about the union, because the first thing I did, and they told me, well, we have a restrictive clause, but I tell you what, and I talked to a young man who was the vice president of the district, who was very progressive and quite liberal. He told me, he says, look, if you want to join the union, I will see that you get in. And he did.
Was that Clarence Gibson?
No. No, that was Sid Wachs. But after getting in, Clarence Gibson was one of those few who stood out and maintained that we should recognize everybody. And, of course, the answer to the question was no. They didn't come seeking us with open arms. We got in and tried to fight that restricted clause because they had a bar against blacks specifically. And the quote went something like this: "You swore that you would not accept anything but a competent white candidate. This meant within it or out of it. In other words, you swore that if you became a member of this organization, that you would never submit for membership a black, even if you weren't in a working in a trade. And of course, recognizing this, it was hard for me to accept it. I felt that here we were engaged in a war called democracy, for democracy, and it was certainly far less than that that we were exercising within the labor movement and giving all efforts to further the cause of democracy at the same time as defeating that purpose. I got with a few guys and we started a movement.
I was looking through the American Aeronaut, which was the paper of Lodge 727. Mm-hmm. Well, it still is, I imagine. But one thing I found there, the only mention I found of black members throughout the whole war years, maybe I just wasn't looking closely enough, was an article in November of 1941, which was inviting black members or black employees to come to Lodge 22 and join the IAM. And they were making a friendly overture, but what was the difference between 727 and 22?
Lodge 22?
Lodge 22.
You know, in 41, that was a little before my time, I joined Lockheed in 42. That was in 41, you're talking about, all right?
November 41.
Okay. It was in March of 42 that I came into Lockheed. And at that time, of course, I don't recall Lodge 22. The lodges, from the time that I went in, were an alphabet like A, B, C, F, so on.
Those were the local lodges.
Local lodges.
22 was a district.
Oh, 22, district. I don't even recall 22, district 22. Hmm. First off, I wasn't too familiar with the structure. Mm-hmm. And my efforts more or less were confined to 727, okay? And it wasn't until, I guess, 47, 45, and doing this fight, certainly, I become certainly far more familiar with machinist, period. And doing that whole period, I've become knowledgeable about the structure organizationally, and, the districts and the locals and the whole bit. But 22, I don't recall at all.
Yeah, it seemed strange to me also, and I was just wondering if this might have been some attempt on the IAM's part to have a Jim Crow auxiliary of some kind.
You know, I don't ever recall at any time that District 727 mm-hmm. has emphasized or made any efforts to have a Jim Crow union.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you what happened, I can well remember that the district was brought to task at one time in that it was swearing in people coming into the local, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Harvey Brown at that time was the international president, and he was there. And the question was raised at that point when they talked about accepting nothing but white candidates. And his reference, and I remember well, was that it had nothing to do with the color of your skin, but the inside. Okay? And that's the way they avoided this question. The whole idea was to minimize as much as possible raising or rocking the boat or anything like this where it would have caused a confrontation. That was the whole idea. Certainly it didn't mean that. It didn't mean what Harley said, and we all knew it. But that was the way it was described.
Mm-hmm.
Something I've never voiced appealing for Jim Crow. I mean, for Jim Crow or special kind of thing. But this did happen. Within the shipyards up north in Oregon area and the Washington area, the shipyards, they did have what was called auxiliary. And, of course, there were those, of course, who wanted to have this. And I can well remember one of the vice presidents, or rather one of the aspiring that time vice president, was one of those, of course, who emphasized. His name was Roy Brown. He really emphasized that they should have, and we should fight for this, they should fight for this village kind of thing. There were a number of encounters that we had had with Roy as a vice president. I know I talked with Roy a number of times at that time and tried to get him moved away from that position and hoping to use him as one of those persons in a position in the executive council to come out strong against this clause. He never did. And, that is a part of history.
Would you say that the attitude of the leadership and rank and file of Lodge 727 was not typical of the national philosophy of the IAM, or?
Well, I would say that it's a strange kind of thing, and in my own way of making any kind of analysis, it would be this way. California at the time was a budding area aircraft, okay? And you had any number of migrants who were coming in. And they were coming in from all parts of the country. And if you recall, we were on the tail end of a depression. And people were anxious to get jobs, and they were delighted to get jobs. And I think what happened in this situation, they put this on the back burner as far as accepting blacks into, say, the union or into the shops. But I'll tell you what happened, though. Once they got in the shops, once these people come in, and certainly those who come from the South particularly, made it pretty difficult for blacks coming in. I recall that when Lockheed decided that they were going to have blacks in, I understood they called meetings with supervision, they called meetings with the people, letting them know that blacks were coming in. And when the blacks did come in, because I was in, the second wave of blacks to come into Lockheed, they were hired into the menial jobs, of course, janitors and some of the most dirtiest jobs, sandblast operators, because that's what I came in as, a sandblast operator. And it was nothing to hear the remarks of bigots and common reference to blacks. Anytime you could be, say, particularly in went into the restaurant, nothing to have this kind of conversation going on. And it was done deliberately, either to somehow scare you if possible, or to embarrass you to such an extent that you wouldn't want to stay. I can remember the encounters that I've had, but and I can well remember some of the others that were had. I can remember the fights that were had. But in the beginning, it wasn't really big, you know, but it was there. It was there. And I would say, of course, as time went on, people began to understand that these feelings couldn't be openly expressed. They weren't condoned by management. Once they reported, of course, they made efforts to do something about it. And this I do know.
Your philosophy was to work inside the IAM to try to redress any of the problems that were going on rather than going outside with a suit against the union.
Yes. You know, I was young in this whole affair, and certainly my knowledge is limited as to the legal questions involved. And I can well remember, to protect myself, because we were working in an atmosphere of McCarthyism, okay? And the union was utilizing this to the hilt. Any one that was emphasizing and working to get these things changed, that they would label them, okay? And in order to protect myself and others in this movement and little organization that we had called the Yay Vote Committee, we drew from the community leaders, non-citizens that we knew, like Thomas Jefferson, who's now a judge of the Superior Court, who was a part of the advisory committee, Lauren Miller, of course, who was made a judge, but who was one of the staunch fighters in housing, who changed the housing pattern here to the Supreme Court, Fay Allen, who was the first, I think the first black on the Board of Education, who was a teacher in the school that I graduated from, Thomas Jefferson High School, Leon Washington, of course, who was one of the forefront fighters of desegregating creches on Central Avenue. Gus Hawkins, at the time, of course, who was in the assembly. And I'm naming those I can just throw off because they were advisors to us. And the advice was, you can't cure something outside. You do it on the inside. And I was under a lot of pressure to sue, and that wasn't the aim, and it certainly wasn't my intent. And I always felt, you don't destroy something that you feel is good, in spite of the fact that we were, so to speak, bottom of the totem pole, and as far as having any, say, view as to when this thing would end. We didn't know when it would end. But I recognize that it's better to do it on the inside, where you can. You haven't changed anything but what they should have done. It has not subjected to any legal conditions of destruction possibly or whatever, because in the labor movement at that time certainly wasn't acceptable. Any more than it is now, it's been far less acceptable. So with that idea, I felt certainly it was better, and tried to encourage others to stay in, to fight inside, to go to union meetings, to do these kind of things. We weren't encouraged by the union, because there were many of our people, of course, who were given their money back anytime they addressed this question to the district president.
Give me your
dues. Dues back. Money back. Whatever amount you put in, we'll give it back to you. There was some, of course, who gladly stuck it. I tried to tell them, what are you going to do out there? And that's a penance, the money you're getting back, you know. But there was some that did.
How did most of your co-workers react to this, the other black workers? Were they persuaded by you to take this type of strategy towards working within the union, or did they develop anti-union feelings? Or?
No. They didn't develop anti-union feelings. They did develop anti-IFM. Hmm. What it really did was, you have to understand something. I said at the beginning, we had the CIOs accepting everybody, okay? We were organizing these various aircraft plants. And where blacks went, if they left Lockheed and they went to North American, North American, of course, was at one time in a big fight with the machinists. Well, you see, the blacks weren't going to accept the machines under no circumstances. They would vote definitely for the CIO. CIO had the North American. And wherever in the areas the blacks were, this was made known. So, no, they didn't develop anti-labor feelings. but they sure developed anti-machinism.
Did the CIO or the UAW work with you in your efforts at Lockheed, or were you, did you have any contact with them directly in your work there?
No.
Moral support of any kind?
No. Well, I recognized that the CIO was, I guess, for lack of a better word, an adversary, in that how would they work with me to better condition the machines when they were competing for the same people to become their organization, a part of the organization? So, no, I knew a number of people within the CIO. I knew a number of blacks. I worked with them in the community. But as far as aiding and assisting in the effort to correct the condition of the machines, no.
So people like Reverend Clayton didn't have much impact on what you were doing?
Clayton Russell?
Yeah.
Yes. But if you mean Revels Clayton.
Revels Clayton.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, he wasn't?
No, that's it. Revels Clayton. Revels Clayton. It was later that Revels Clayton came into the picture where we worked very close together in discrimination in a lot of areas. Many areas, but that was well after, I would say, well into when the machinist was making efforts and doing a number of things, you know, to correct the situation. Yeah. But you mentioned, I thought you meant Reverend Clayton Russell. Reverend Clayton Russell was a big fighter here in the cause for equality. And, of course, we worked closely with Reverend Clayton.
I guess I just got the name.
Yeah, well, it's similar.
Yeah.
But Revels Clayton was
vice president of the CIO.
I think he was. Yeah. I know he was well up there. And, of course, he was stigmatized later. Then, of course, he moved up north, and he was later, I think, assistant to the mayor there. What's his name? Ali Oda. He was something there at Ali Oda for a long while. Yeah. And he's been tight. The Reverend, I think, was with the longshowman there for a while or something. But anyway, that's what it was then.
You said stigmatized and labeled. Did this refer to red dating?
Red dating.
Or,
right.
And what? How did the company use that against people in the union? Or did the union even use it?
Oh, yes, the union used it.
Yeah.
Well, I can, I guess, make myself an example. Because I was in the forefront, because I was leading the fight, they put, they meaning the union, would, they put the FBI on to me. Okay? Now, they would come into my community, into my neighborhood, and ask my neighbors about me, what kind of person I was, and all these kind of things. And of course, my neighbors would tell me, you know, they said, what are you doing? You know, we had people come here asking about you and these kind of things. I said, well, I don't know. I don't know. I really don't. And it wasn't until later that I found out it was the FBI. Now, then the company, the first time the company called me in was shortly after I got to Lockheed, and, well, after I got involved in the union, okay? They called me in, and there was an FBI agent who was in personnel, going over my whole background. They wanted to know about me and all of these kind of things. And I wasn't too well up on what was taking place. And he identified himself as a government inspector or something like this. And he wanted to know my history. And I had to go back and tell him all of everything from the time that I left home, what transpired in that period, leaving home and getting to California. I went through the whole story. And he told me that that wasn't true. Life went to you like that, you know. I said, well, I don't know where you've been, but I know where I came from, and I know what I went through. And I went to tell him about the things that I went through. Mm-hmm. Because coming here, we went through a lot of things, oh boy, and the other thing was it. on the, no reason at all, put in jail, on a P phone, all these kind of things, like pennies. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. But the thing was, it just made me more determined to leave it and to get where I thought. At least I'd have an equal shape. But again, that's a story in itself. He didn't want to believe this kind of thing. Well, the follow-up from that was, I guess it must have been maybe a year or two before they bothered me again. Because I don't know whether it was before or after the 45 convention in New York City. And, of course, I went there. I went there, we raised money, the group raised money and the whole bit to send me there as a buttonholer, you know, and to try to get entry.